is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
But eventually we feel that that immunity is going to decay. Now, at this stage, it's too early to know how frequently we're going to need boosters in healthy individuals.
That's Barry Shoup, the epidemiologist in charge of South Africa's scientific response to COVID-19. Details coming up also. Cameroonian women want the separatist crisis that has killed at least 3,000 people in the country's western region to stop. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The World Health Organization, or WHO, says many African countries have yet to vaccinate 1% of their populations against COVID-19 as outbreaks intensify across the continent. This while wealthier countries who've immunized their most vulnerable citizens stockpile jabs to prepare for the possibility of a third round of vaccinations. The WHO says Africa simply does not have the means to buy sufficient COVID-19 shots fast enough, and many thousands of lives are being lost because of the so-called vaccine inequity. Darren Taylor has more.
The epidemiologist in charge of South Africa's scientific response to the pandemic, Barry Shoup, says there are good reasons to give a third vaccine dose to people with weaker immune systems.
So this would be people with undercurrent illnesses or people on various treatments for cancer, for example, illnesses such as HIV and so on, where they're not responding as well to the normal two doses of Pfizer, for example. So a booster dose is being considered to actually again stimulate the immune system to get an immune response.
But like the WHO, many scientists believe it's in the world's best interests to make sure all vulnerable people around the globe have received at least one jab before any move is made toward third shots. They say it may be morally questionable for richer countries to buy millions of doses while poorer regions such as Africa struggle for supplies. But such stockpiling has a scientific basis.
These are excellent vaccines, let's make no mistake about it. They've radically reduced severe disease, which really is the main aim at this stage of vaccination. So they're very good vaccines. But on the other hand, they're not as good as, for example, measles vaccine is one example, or polio, or any of those vaccines, which give very long-lasting, sometimes even lifelong immunity.
Shoup says it's impossible to say how long the available vaccines will protect against serious COVID-19.
But eventually we feel that that immunity is going to decay. Now, at this stage, it's too early to know how frequently we're going to need boosters in healthy individuals. It may be annually, maybe every 2 years, every 5 years. We don't know at this stage. I think we can be pretty confident that we will need boosters at a future time.
He says, again, wealthier nations are buying all the different vaccines available based on current scientific knowledge.
There has been some evidence of some mixing of vaccines, which does have an advantage. Now, whether it's going to be that or whether the vaccines will need to be tweaked, I think they will need to be tweaked. Remember, we're only now in our first generation of vaccines. There will be improvements of vaccines as the science of vaccines develops.
Health activists say these improvements will result in richer countries dumping their original vaccines on Africa in the future. Shoup says the world's also going to need a lot more different vaccines because COVID-19's constantly mutating and throwing up new variants, making it unlikely for populations to ever achieve so-called herd immunity.
These variants occur in individuals who don't respond that well and where the virus continues to multiply. And as the virus multiplies, it's got more chance of being selected to escape the immunity. So it's not going to be that the population's immune. That's really the way that we have to deal with the virus, to stop it multiplying in individuals and to get as many people immunized as quickly as possible. That's really the aim.
Right now, says the WHO, that's far from being achieved in Africa, where life-saving vaccines remain rare. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Tigrayan forces have advanced south and pushed into the Afar region to the east and have said they will push west and try to restore their pre-war boundaries. Western Tigray is currently controlled by Amhara forces who say the land rightfully belongs to them. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi the strategic and political gains the Tigrayan forces could harvest if they manage to restore their pre-war land.
First off, I think it's important to recognize that western part of Tigray, the part that has been claimed by the Amhara forces, is very strategic, because it's the part of Tigray that borders Sudan. And so it's an important outlet for Tigray for trade and supply routes and access to the international community. Tigray otherwise is bordered by Ethiopia in the south and Eritrea in the north and east. And so it clearly feels encircled. So I think strategically, that's an important region. I think politically, if Tigrayans were to simply try and reclaim and defend their territory and highlight the abuses that they have suffered as a result of some of the actions of the federal government and the Eritrean forces who came in, then they would be in a much stronger position to command international support and defend their actions. And I think that way they would also be in a stronger position to demand a ceasefire, call for a political solution. And that would be the clearest path, you know, we can see to a shorter ending of this conflict, to the extent that, you know, they go into new territories and new grievances are created, it becomes more complicated and therefore a farther away from a resolution.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Uganda's government says reopening schools will depend on the success of its drive to vaccinate students against COVID-19. The government is considering vaccinating all students over age 12 to ensure a safe and sustainable resumption of teaching and learning. The plan relies on supplies of Pfizer vaccine once they are secured. Katrin Nambi reports from Kampala.
While imposing a lockdown to stem the spread of COVID-19 in Uganda's second wave in June, President Yoweri Museveni blamed teaching institutions for being behind the rise in cases. According to Museveni, schools were not disclosing the number of teachers and students who tested positive for the coronavirus. Museveni last week eased the lockdown, allowing public and private transport as well as opening trading areas, including malls and shopping centers. However, he noted that schools will remain closed until an unspecified number of students is vaccinated.
Scientists have informed me that children above 12 to 18 years can also be vaccinated using the Pfizer vaccine. I've directed the Minister of Health to include this age group in their estimates and plan holistically. So learning should continue virtually. Minister of Education and Sports will provide learning materials to learners.
Janet Kataha Museveni is Uganda's education minister. She confirms that plans are underway to have students vaccinated ahead of the reopening.
Government is trying to access sufficient vaccines so that we can have all the 18-year-olds and above students from universities and technical institutes vaccinated at least. And then we're looking for vaccines that can vaccinate children in lower schools, 12 to 18. Then we would open schools. That is not to say that they can't get COVID-19 again. They can, but at least it will be mild.
In September, the U.S. government is expected to donate 640,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine in the campaign to treat students. Over 15 million students in Uganda have had their studies interrupted since March 2020, when the first lockdown was announced as a measure to curb the spread of COVID-19 in Uganda. However, the acquisition of vaccines in Uganda is slow, and it is not likely the schools will reopen soon. Uganda's vaccination drive targets about 22 million people, but the health ministry says that to date, just over a million people have been vaccinated, with nearly 241,000 having received the two AstraZeneca jabs. Uganda so far has confirmed nearly 94,500 COVID-19 cases and close to 3,000 deaths. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
More than 1,000 Cameroonian women have asked for an immediate end to hostilities and inclusive dialogue to stop a deepening separatist crisis that has killed at least 3,000 people in the Central African state's western regions. The women gathered at a conference in the capital Yaoundé also told stories of torture by both separatist fighters and government troops. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
This song, referred to as the Cameroonian Women's Anthem, blasts through loudspeakers at a conference center in Yaoundé. The singers say they want bloodshed in the Central African state's English-speaking regions to stop. Among the 1,000 women at the peace conference, which ended Saturday night, was Caroline Agbo, a teacher from Mamfe, an English-speaking southwestern town. Agbo said that in September 2018, separatist fighters amputated parts of her body. She says she could only raise $50 of the $200 the fighters asked her to contribute so they could buy weapons.
They said it was not enough and asked that they don't want to support us to buy bullets. My left hand, first three fingers have been cut. My spinal cord had about four wounds. It was in the hospital that I realized that I had multiple wounds. God rescued me, I'm still alive.
The women also told stories of being tortured and raped, allegedly at the hands of government troops and separatist fighters. Both the military and government have refuted allegations of government troops raping women and girls, but promised to sanction any troops found guilty of rape. A group called Northwest Southwest Women Task Force, in collaboration with other women's associations, organized the peace meeting. Eileen Manka is the spokesperson of the task force that educates civilians to seek peaceful solutions to conflicts. She says women and girls are the hardest hit by the conflict.
It's the women who are left behind to bury the dead, to take care of the wounded. And you see, when the woman wants to run away from conflict, she must run with her children. When the man is fleeing, he flees alone. Individual women who started up businesses, their businesses were burnt down. We have cases of women who have run to the cities. And as we know, they are now prostitutes. We have cases of young girls who are now being raped in the cities as a result of the conflict in the Northwest and the Southwest.
Cameroon's ministries of basic and secondary education report that 60% of the 600,000 children who have not been able to attend school since the separatist crisis started in 2016 are girls. 75% of the 100,000 farmers who have fled their properties in the English-speaking western regions are women, and 60% of the people who have abandoned their shops are female. Roselyn Oba is the coordinator of the Cameroon Community Media Network that uses the media to advocate for a return to peace. She says the peace meeting asks government troops and separatist fighters to immediately end hostilities. She says the government and fighters should engage in what she calls true dialogue around peace, solidarity, and shared humanity in Cameroon.
No true peace talks can happen in the midst of extreme gun violence, reason why one of the major recommendations of the women is that the hostilities have to end immediately. And then, of course, we go to the negotiating table. Genuine and intentional dialogue. Because if it is not an inclusive process, we end up playing to the gallery and we wouldn't have any solution.
The women said they will work for peace within their respective families and communities. Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ondua, Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment, says the government will examine the proposals made by the women.
We need all forces to rebuild, restore, and consolidate peace in Cameroon. We have received the call for peace and have responded by saying we are ready. Know that the government of the Republic salutes your commitment and promises all the necessary support.
The UN reports that more than 3,000 people have been killed in Cameroon's English-speaking regions since fighting broke out in 2017. The unrest was sparked by English-speaking teachers and lawyers protesting Francophone dominance. Armed groups took over the movement, demanding independence for an English-speaking state they call Ambazonia. Their demands were met with a government crackdown and calls to surrender or be killed. More than 550,000 people, the majority women and children, have been displaced from the restive English-speaking regions to safer French-speaking towns and to neighboring Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Nigerian police authorities have appointed a new intelligence chief after suspending Deputy Commissioner Abba Kyari, who has been indicted in a million-dollar fraud case in the United States. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigeria's police chief, Alkali Baba, approved the appointment on Monday and said the new intelligence head, Tunji Disu, will assume office immediately. The appointment comes on the heels of fraud allegations against former intelligence head Abba Kyari, who was indicted by the U.S. Justice Department last week in connection with Nigerian Ramon Abbas, a.k.a. Ray Hushpuppi, facing trial for fraud in the U.S. Kyari has denied involvement, but police authorities on Friday said they were investigating the issue and later suspended him. Authorities also set up a four-person investigation team to look into the matter. Last week, Abba Kyari was indicted by a U.S. court in California over alleged involvement in internet fraud of more than $1.1 million. Before the appointment, Disu led the rapid response team in Lagos. He will lead the police intelligence unit pending the outcome of the investigations. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The government of Zimbabwe is battling to pay farmers for grains and commodities sold to the National Marketing Board. It owes the farmers millions of U.S. dollars for this year and last year's harvests. Adigando gives us more on the story.
This week, legislators debated the massive debts owed to cotton farmers on deliveries made last year amounting to 1.5 billion Zimbabwean dollars or U.S. 17.4 million. Agriculture Minister Anxious Masuka told Parliament that the government has failed to pay cotton farmers outstanding balance owed them from the last growing season. According to official Agriculture Ministry statistics, Zimbabwe recorded a bumper harvest in the last farming season. It was a period marked by heavy rains and the official estimates of maize output of between 2.5 million and 2.8 million metric tons, with an additional 360,000 metric tons of grains expected to be delivered to the Grain Marketing Board. Despite the positive news, the National Granary, with the sole mandate of buying maize, is failing to pay farmers. This year's producer price has been pegged at 32,000 Zimbabwean dollars, or about US$376. That brings the total required to close to 80 billion Zimbabwean dollars, or 930 million US dollars. Currently, the marketing board is struggling to pay $5 billion owed to farmers. Earlier this year, Central Bank Governor John Mangudya indicated a likely government plan to raise about $60 billion or about $697 million amid criticism by some economists. They say the government would be forced to print money to pay the farmers, a move that could well bring about hyperinflation. Economic analyst Prosper Chitambara weighs in, saying the government has few options.
We hope that government will not seek recourse to money supply growth or seniorage to finance that purchase, otherwise that could be inflationary. And even when you consider the whole Ministry of Agriculture budget for the year, it's far less than the $80 billion that is needed to buy maize from farmers. So I think that's a big challenge.
Economic analyst Stevenson Tlamini says the government might have to resort to other payment measures because the failure to pay farmers could undermine projected growth targets.
Most likely the government is going to issue treasury bills in an effort to try and raise funds for the settlement of this debt. And this will obviously increase the domestic debt, which is contrary to what the fiscal policy priorities or targets have been as announced by the Minister of Finance. All things being equal, would have said the government could give these farmers inputs for them to make sure that they transit into the next season efficiently. But you'd appreciate these farmers so relying on that source of income for their own sustenance.
Meanwhile, the government says it will issue so-called agro bills worth $20 billion. $242 million. It says the money is intended to provide farmers in the 2021-22 summer season with seed, chemicals, mechanization, irrigation, fertilizers, electricity, labor, combined harvesting services, and transportation. Program beneficiaries will include a combination of small to large-scale producers and suppliers of inputs. The fund will be used in the production of maize, soybeans, traditional grains, and sunflowers. Economic analysts like Prosper Chitambara, however, believe that the government is shouldering more than it can and should carry under normal circumstances. They maintain that structural issues need to be addressed for private sector to participate in financing the agriculture sector.
Well, assisting farmers should not just be a government-only undertaking. I think there is scope and room for private sector financing to complement government, but obviously the issue of land tenure needs to be finalized because until and unless the private financiers are content and happy with the land tenure, then it may be difficult to unlock private sector financing.
Observers and economic analysts say the successful financing of the sector whittles down to investor confidence in government policies. They note that so far support for government efforts by the business community has been an uphill battle. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Africans won silver medals in track and field and wrestling at the Tokyo Summer Olympic today. And they also placed three runners into the men's 5,000 meters. Namibia's Christine Mboma finished second in the women's 200 meters behind Jamaica's Elaine Thompson-Herah, who added to her gold vault after winning the 100 meters earlier. Two Egyptians won silver in the men's wrestling, Mohamed Ibrahim El Said Ibrahim at 67 kilograms and Mohamed Mustafa Matawili at 77 kilos. Nigerian's Blessing Oborududu won silver in the women's 68 kilogram wrestling class. And two Namibian women, Christine Mboma and Patrice Masalingi, have advanced to the 200-meter finals. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.